From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is off today.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Yellowstone National Park as the National Park Service turns 100 years old. This is Here and Now. And right now, Meghna, we are sitting at the Old Faithful Inn, which has been here since 1904. The park was made the first national park in 1916. And we are looking out right in front of us, about 250 yards in front of us, is Old Faithful. Now, it's just steaming at the moment. I think it's about to go off maybe in the next half hour or so. It erupts about every 90 minutes, and we're hoping that during the show we'll be on the air for another eruption. And there are geysers also to our left and behind us. They're on their own schedules, but the energy that causes the eruption comes from the same place, which is a huge supervolcano that is underneath us.
Yeah, don't the geysers understand radio clocks? They need to do it while we're on the air. But in addition to that, Yellowstone has got a lot of great, beautiful wildlife as well.
Yeah, grizzly bears and bison. There was a bison hanging out near us this morning. You're not supposed to get close, and we did not. But a whole lot to talk about as the Park Service turns 100 on our live broadcast from Yellowstone, and we will do that. But right now, let's talk politics for a few minutes. Donald Trump seems to be wavering on one of his biggest campaign staples. That would be immigration. He is in Ohio tonight for a rally. Hillary Clinton in California for an appearance on Jimmy Kimmel Live and for a fundraiser. And joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
It's great to have you. And I want to start with a clip of Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, talking about immigration with CNN's Dana Bash yesterday.
As the weeks unfold, he will lay out the specifics of that plan that he would implement as president of the United States.
Will that plan include a deportation force, the kind that he talked about during the Republican primaries?
To be determined.
To be determined, Ron, what is that about? And remind us, not just about a deportation force, but what Trump has proposed when it comes to immigration.
Jeremy, the key of the Trump policy on immigration is to put illegal immigration to an end as a problem, as an issue, as a concern for the nation. He wanted to build and has said many, many times that he will build a wall across the entire border of the United States and Mexico. And this particular policy has been absolutely key to his success in the Republican primaries. Deportation voters, that is to say, voters who favored not only a wall with Mexico, but the deportation of all illegal immigrants in the United States today, made up the majority of people who voted for Donald Trump in almost every primary state.
So if he moderates that position, and by the way, forgive the delay and the sound quality here, we are, you know, very far away from internet and any of that kind of stuff, but if he is to moderate that position, is he going to lose his base?
It is a keep your word issue for Donald Trump's voters. And it does not only speak to immigration, which, as we know, is a tremendously important issue to these voters. They did favor a deportation force to round people up, put them on buses, and get them out of the country. Not only does it matter on that particular issue, but it also goes to a world of other issues, most particularly Supreme Court appointments. Because people have questioned in the Republican Party whether or not Donald Trump would really appoint true Antonin Scalia-type conservatives to the Supreme Court. He says he will, but if he were to change his position on something as high profile as immigration, then those questions are going to arise again, and there'll be real unease among serious ideological conservatives.
So, Ron, we've been hearing about the idea of a pivot in the Trump campaign, and not just on policy, perhaps, but also on his tone. But then he sent these tweets today aimed at MSNBC Morning Joe host Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. And here's one of them. Quote, someday when things calm down, I'll tell the real story of Joe and his very insecure longtime girlfriend, Morning Mika, two clowns. And in another, he called Brzezinski a neurotic mess. Is that a pivot, or what's going on there?
You know, there's really been a mixed signal coming from these new people at the top of the Trump campaign, just brought on last week or promoted last week within the Trump organization. And it's clear that Kellyanne Conway, whom we heard from a moment ago, is there to soften his image with certain kinds of voters, try to get some Hispanic votes, try to get some African-American votes, and mostly to try to moderate his image among white college-educated women who usually vote Republican but right now are not voting for Donald Trump. Then he also has a new chairman of his campaign, a new CEO of his campaign in Steve Bannon, and his job is to continue the reputation Donald Trump has had for shredding his enemies. So I think we're seeing some of both.
Ron, I want to ask you about one more thing real quick here. There's some news today from a Texas judge who granted a nationwide injunction on the Obama administration's guidance on transgender bathrooms. What does this mean?
It means that a lot of schools are opening this week and next week in a lot of confusion about this particular policy. They know that they've been told by the federal government back in May that transgender students must be allowed to use bathrooms and locker rooms consistent with their chosen gender identity. Many of them, though, with this one judge in Texas making this ruling, will decide to stay just where they were and tell them they had to use the bathroom that's on their birth certificate.
We'll keep watching. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy. Give my best to Old Faithful.
The Prairie Pothole Region is an area that stretches from Canada down through the Dakotas, northern Montana, western Minnesota, and northwest Iowa. It was an expansive and biodiverse prairie and wetland, but the natural habitat is rapidly disappearing as farms are getting bigger and bigger. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters reports on the implications this growth has on everything from wildlife to what's on our dinner plates.
Lush green northern North Dakota prairie stretches off into the distance. The horizon is dotted with small blue bodies of water. Frank Rohrer with Delta Waterfowl hops off his red all-terrain vehicle. He's looking for duck nests. He and a colleague have a long chain connecting their two ATVs. They drive slowly, dragging the chain through the grass. When it brushes over a duck, it flies from the nest.
That was a blue-winged teal. It just flushed from the chain.
Delta Waterfowl, a nonprofit conservation group, inventories this duck breeding ground once a week. Rohrer says this area is intensely farmed for corn and soybeans. As a result, they're struggling to find the best habitat for eggs to hatch.
Probably the best way is to have it be like it was when we arrived. Have a sea of grass. Well, that's not going to happen.
Rohrer says the taxpayer-backed Federal Conservation Reserve Program, which pays farmers to turn cropland into prairie, has been great for preserving grasslands and waterfowl. But the federal farm bill has capped that at 24 million acres. And the Prairie Pothole Region has significant losses in its conservation land. So money from hunters helps fund these wetlands. Rex Johnson is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, stationed in Iowa. It's the state with the most extreme loss of prairie pothole habitat. Johnson says nearly all of it is gone.
You can understand why we wanted to do it, because it made life possible. It freed up extraordinarily productive farmland, and it allowed for the construction of this network of roads. You know, people could suddenly live in this landscape much more easily than they could before. Okay? We just went too far.
High prices for corn and soybeans led to more and more farmers ripping up prairie and expanding their crops. And Johnson says federal crop insurance was an incentive for farmers to expand. After all, corn and soybean prices were high for quite a while. Even if crops never make it to market, crop insurance still pays out.
And I don't think as a people, if we knew what we were doing, we really want to subsidize the loss of wetlands.
With more farmland also comes more pesticide use. Studies show neonicotinoid pesticides are detrimental to honeybees that pollinate crops. Clint Otto is a research ecologist with the Northern Prairie Wildlife Research Center. He uses honeybees as a model organism to study land use and how it affects people's lives.
Between 65 and 80% of our U.S. pollination needs are met by honeybees that spend the summer in the northern Great Plains.
Otto says think of it as one in every three bites of food a human eats is thanks to the work of pollinators.
The dinner plate looks a lot less appealing when you take pollinators out of the equation, that's for sure.
Back in Iowa, there are concerns about what turning all this prairie into farmland does to water that flows from farm fields. The city of Des Moines gets its water from two rivers that are full of nitrates, a fertilizer byproduct that in high levels can be harmful to babies and pregnant women. The city's water utility is embroiled in a legal fight, citing the cost of treating the water for human consumption. Rex Johnson with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says agribusiness is structured in a way that rewards farmers who try to maximize profits. But he says that can create long-term social, economic, and health problems.
As these ecological problems start to crop up, as we reach the tipping point, agriculture as an industry will recognize that it's in their best interest to start behaving in an ecologically more sensitive manner.
Some would argue the tipping point has been reached. In the meantime, some farmers and conservationists in the Pothole region are working together to see if Midwest farming can coexist with natural habitat and sustain quality public health. For Here and Now, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines, Iowa.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at Old Faithful at Yellowstone National Park as the Park Service celebrates 100 years of existence this week. And just as this park looks different than any other place on Earth, it also sounds different. And there's a woman whose job it is to document that sound. Her name is Jennifer Jarrett, and she records the sounds of Yellowstone as part of a partnership between the park and the Acoustic Atlas, a nature and soundscape archive at the Montana State University Library. I met up with her outside on a bench across from an active geyser. She had her laptop filled with the sounds she's recorded and two little speakers, and I asked her why it's so important to record the sounds of Yellowstone.
The short story, I guess, is that these sounds could go away. You know, we're losing species at an unprecedented rate in human history, and I don't need to tell you that there's probably more to come. So from that perspective, it's important to document what's out there and get a record of these players in our soundscapes.
And in order to get the sounds, do you have to get into some dangerous situations? Because some of these animals you probably wouldn't want to hang out with one-on-one.
I am very cognizant of not getting myself into dangerous situations. That's a really big component of my planning phase of gathering recordings. And I have a couple of tricks to keep myself safe. And one of them, you know, oftentimes I'll do some recording just from the safety of my vehicle and put the microphone out, run a cable into the car and sit in the car and record. I also use remote recording devices, especially for situations where it wouldn't make sense for me to be present. And otherwise, I keep my distance. You know, I stay 100 yards away from wolves and bears, 25 yards away from everything else. And the mics I use are pretty powerful, so they have a long reach, and I'm able to get great recordings in spite of the distance.
Well, let's hear some of the sounds that you have collected while you've been here, starting with what?
You know, I was actually going to start with a simple recording of a meadowlark. And the thing that I like about this recording is that the meadowlark, the western meadowlark, really spends a lot of its time in the sagebrush steppe. And in Yellowstone National Park, we have a lot of sagebrush communities. And it's kind of easy, an easy little ecosystem to overlook. But in the whole world, we have this in North America only. So it's a special system, and over 350 species rely on the sagebrush steppe.
So tell us what we're hearing there.
So what you heard is runoff from the Mammoth Hot Springs thermal system has a runoff channel that runs down the hill and kind of behind the residence area. And so this was just me getting up early one spring morning and heading down with my gear, setting it up right at that runoff channel. And there was a meadowlark who flew in and just perched very close to me in the microphone and just sang his heart out.
Okay, what is next on your list?
So this is, every fall, we have the elk rut, the mating season for elk. And in Mammoth, there's kind of a resident elk herd. And what happens is that there'll be a couple main bulls who are competing for dominance, for the privilege of breeding with the cows that are up there. And then oftentimes there'll be some satellite bulls around in the area hoping to also kind of step up and compete. And this was late at night, and literally right across the street from the house, these two bull elk got into it and just started fighting, clacking antlers, the whole deal. It was crazy.
And how close was your microphone?
I was about, I'd say I was 30 yards away from these guys, so pretty close. But this is the scene in Upper Mammoth, like every night, all night long. And I call it elksomnia because you don't get any sleep because the elk are just going crazy all night long.
Now, how does this fight end?
You know, it seems like one animal kind of gets tired and just defers to the other one. It's wild. It's not like it ends in death or something really dramatic. It's just they'll fight for a while, and then it's like there's some kind of unspoken agreement between these two guys, and it's like, okay, man, you win.
Okay, we've had our beautiful songbird and now our fight. What's next?
Okay, next up, let's listen to sort of a quintessential sound of Yellowstone.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so those wolves, those were the Lamar Canyon pack. I recorded that this past January from the road. So when we were talking about recording from the safety of the car, that was one of those instances. And not that wolves are dangerous, but it's more I just don't want to impact the behavior of the animals. I'm trying not to have them be hyper aware of my presence. But it was very cool. They were pretty close and kind of circling the parking area and then moving off into the sage. And what was really interesting about that recording is right in the beginning, did you hear it sounded like a dog whining? Okay, so that was something that even the researchers hadn't really heard before. Oftentimes when you're out watching wolves or if I'm trying to record wolves, they're very, very far away. So you don't have the opportunity to get that kind of detail. So that was a very cool thing.
Now, it's not just animals that you record, but also some of the geology here, some of the geysers and things like that.
Exactly. Absolutely. I spend a fair bit of my time recording the thermal features in the park. And it's important to kind of point out about this is that as water moving through the landscape changes, whether that's seasonally or as a result of longer-term impacts from things like climate change, you know, so too will the sounds of these thermal features change. So again, an important thing to document. One of my favorite things to record are the mud pots. And so this next recording is fountain paint pots.
And we should say there's not like a hippopotamus in there or something like that.
No, that is just all of the thermal activity, the release of heat and gases through that mud that microbes and other chemical reactions have kind of broken down rock to create this mud. And then that's just all that activity bubbling up through the mud.
And do you have to be careful about exactly when you record that to get it to sound like that, or is it kind of like that all the time?
Well, I mean, it'll kind of do glurpity-glurpity all year round, but definitely in the springtime when more water is moving through the system, it sounds like that. That was recorded in, I think, early May. And then later in the year, it's not as much, but you can still get some nice recordings.
So much activity going on in there.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? I could totally just sit and listen to mud pots for like 20 minutes. Every time I go record there, it's just, you know, it's easily an hour just monitoring through my headphones because it's like a little meditation just to kind of get into it.
Now, Jennifer, we could not possibly talk to you about the sounds of the park without asking if you've got any sounds of grizzly bears.
I do have sounds of grizzly bears. I have like the recording of grizzly bears. Okay, so early in the program, we talked about, again, the use of remote recorders. This is absolutely a recording that was made with a remote recorder. There was a road-killed bison that park scientists had moved off the road so it didn't pose a safety hazard. And then I went with the bear biologist and we set up a remote field recorder in the hopes of getting the sounds of grizzly bears. And this is what we got.
Now, we're sitting outside right now. I hope that that doesn't call them over here or anything like that right now, does it?
I don't think so. I don't think so. So, I mean, isn't that crazy?
How did you get that?
I set up a remote recorder. I just had it set to record continuously.
But how close is it to the carcass?
From me to you. I mean, those bears, I have sections, I have hours of this. I have sections of recording where you can hear the fur of the bear, you know, rubbing up against the recorder. It's amazing. But so what's even better is that we actually know a little bit about these bears because we also set up a remote camera. And I don't know if these bears were collared or how they were identified, but the grizzly scientists told me that it's a male and a female. They were both about 7 years old. It was recorded in late June, which, you know, does coincide with bear mating season. I don't know if these bears were pairing up or if they just happened to be in the same location feeding on the same carcass, but it was those two bears interacting with each other.
Wow.
So cool.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing these sounds with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Jennifer Jarrett, an audio archivist for Yellowstone. We're here in front of Old Faithful. Could go any minute.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
U.S. regulators have approved the state-owned China National Chemical Corporation's $43 billion purchase of Syngenta, one of the world's biggest agricultural, chemical, and seed producers. And if the sale goes through, it'll be China's biggest ever foreign acquisition. More action on the M&A front is in the works. Pharma giant Pfizer is buying the biotech company Medivation for $14 billion. So joining us now with more is Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Happy Monday to you, Jill.
Yeah, happy merger Monday.
Happy merger Monday. Okay, so let's start with that Pfizer deal. What do they find so attractive about Medivation?
When Medivation has this big prostate cancer drug, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, but it has X's and T's and it's not Mexican. So what I can tell you is that this is a very big business. This drug, I'm going to try Xtandi. There we go.
Yep.
It already generates about $2 billion in yearly sales. And analysts say this could more than double. So this is a big drug and it's already approved. So it's not something in the pipeline. It's making money.
Right. So no development costs when it's already under patent protection and fully approved. Okay. So that's the Pfizer Medivation story. Let's turn back now to China National Chemical Corporation's $43 billion acquisition there. China, obviously state-owned, and Syngenta is a Swiss company. Why is it passing through U.S. regulators?
Well, you know, it's very weird because we have this special committee, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. This is a government body that has the power to block deals that may pose a threat to national security. And the reason that the U.S. is involved is about a quarter of Syngenta sales do come from North America. So every regulator's got a piece in this pie. That's why this deal still has some roadblocks ahead. We've got the European Union's going to weigh in on it. Australia's going to weigh in on it. So a lot of hurdles that face the deal. But it is a massive deal, $43 billion, as
okay.
You said.
Really interesting because last year, Monsanto, you know, not the smallest company in the world, giant Monsanto, also tried to purchase Syngenta, but that deal was rejected. So obviously, these are major hurdles for any company to go through. Why is ChemChina seemingly a better buyer or getting farther along in the process?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the cash component. Monsanto, it was it's a U.S. company, but they were offering a deal that was more of a stock-laden deal. And obviously, for Syngenta to have, it's like you're selling your house. Would you rather have someone who's got to go through a process and raise the money and then, get the mortgage and buy your house? Or someone comes by and says, hey, knock, 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 I've got all cash. So the ChemChina deal definitely is a more cash-heavy deal. And this is also interesting because, as you said, it's state-owned. A lot of regulatory thorniness here. But I also would point out here that it's kind of interesting. It's part of the Chinese companies that are sort of going on a buying spree. And I think this has a lot to do with the slowdown in growth in China itself. And they're looking abroad to start to drive revenue. Once that China miracle goes away, it's like every other company around the world, you've got to look for growth somewhere.
Right. I mean, in January, it took a minority stake in Mercuria, a Swiss energy company. And last year, of course, ChemChina bought Pirelli, the Italian tire maker. So in the last couple seconds that we have, are we likely to see more of this kind of stuff from China?
Oh, absolutely. And they've got the cash to do it. And I think that's really what's driving many of these deals. Find the money and go on and go ahead, give your shareholders something to chew on.
Jill Schlesinger is CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always, Jill.
Take care.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Wyoming in America's first national park. That would be Yellowstone National Park. And we are on the porch of Yellowstone's historic Old Faithful Inn, right across from Old Faithful, with Dan Wenk, who is the superintendent of the park. And Dan, I should say, right now, Old Faithful is any second now supposed to erupt.
It is. We're in the 10-minute interval in terms of plus or minus, and hopefully we'll see it while we're talking.
Explain what that means, because Old Faithful goes off about every 90 minutes or so, but there's always this plus or minus 10 minutes. If we're so sure about when it's going to erupt, why can't we know to the exact minute?
Because we're not that sure. Every eruption is different. Every eruption is a different time, a different volume of water. Therefore, it affects how long it takes the areas to refill with water before it erupts again. So the best we can do is plus or minus 10 minutes.
And it's never not erupted in its 90-minute or window.
It's very rarely it will skip an interval. Hopefully that won't be.
Hopefully that won't happen right now. That would be sad. So let's talk about some of the challenges at the park. And right now, where we're sitting, if you look over the hill at certain times of day, you can see some smoke rising from a fire that has been burning. How worried are you, or at what point do you get worried about some of the fires that are burning in the park?
Well, we're concerned about every fire. But the fires that are burning right now are providing tremendous resource benefit to Yellowstone National Park. Interestingly enough, yesterday they became a size of the largest complex of fires burning in Yellowstone since 1988. But 88, it was over 800,000 acres. Right now, we're about 26,000 acres in total. But these fires are providing great benefit to the resources of Yellowstone and actually providing the kind of mosaic on the landscape that we need to manage fire effectively into the future.
What do you mean they're providing great benefit?
Well, they're regenerating the vegetation. There's some areas of meadows that were really overgrown in terms of the grasses, that we were not getting the kind of production we needed in those grasses to provide a food source for bison and for elk and for other animals. So that's being taken care of.
Are you seeing more fires, though, as a result of climate change?
We're seeing a longer fire season. Typically, 30 to 50 years ago, the fire season would last from July through the end of August. We're now well into September, where if we have starts, we have to be really concerned about where those fire starts are and what kind of resources they could impact.
How else is Yellowstone being affected by climate change?
Well, we have the biggest difference in Yellowstone is it's not the hot temperatures we don't see a lot more hot temperatures in Yellowstone, but we do see some of that. The biggest difference is we're not as cold as we used to be in Yellowstone. And so we don't have as many days of frost. We don't have as much snow production in the winter. The moisture, while it still may be coming in total, we're not having the snowpack, which affects downstream and affects the rivers and streams in terms of the fisheries. So it has a direct effect on the wildlife within the park.
There's another issue going on right now with the Yellowstone River. It's being called a crisis. Tens of thousands of fish are dying, and nearly 200 miles of the river is closed right now. What's going on there?
That's all outside of Yellowstone National Park, and it was a decision made by the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks to ensure that that fishery is the best protected it can be. We are looking at the Yellowstone River within Yellowstone National Park to look at what kind of effects the parasite that they've discovered outside the park. We've not yet found any dead fish within the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park. We're trying to understand how this parasite might act and work. We have some different, they have different stressors outside the park than we do in terms of using water for irrigation, a lot more recreational use, a lot more fishery use. So we have a different set of circumstances, but we are looking at this to see if we need to take any additional actions. Right now, we've not made that determination.
And you don't believe that it's a threat to the park at the moment?
I believe it's a threat, but I'm not sure that we can do anything different than we're doing today to alleviate that threat. So we're just being very watchful and really trying to look at the science that would help us inform any decision-making that we might do.
What about the threat from people? We're sitting right now on this porch. There are a lot of visitors here who are looking out to Old Faithful to watch Old Faithful. There are a lot of visitors in this park, and we've been hearing about people walking off trails, which they're not supposed to do, damaging some of the geysers and the wilderness to get a picture. Is this park being loved to death?
I don't think I'd use the word loved to death. I think this park is being stressed in terms of like never before, because we've had, last year was the highest level of visitation we've ever had on record. This year is going to be more. I think that people are trying
to... I want to stop you right there, because Old Faithful, you can hear the crowd reacting, has just erupted. I know you've probably seen this a million times, but
you never get tired.
Pretty amazing. Wow. Why are we so, and we're going to get back to the crowds, but why are we so fascinated by this?
Well, there's only 300 of those in the world, and half of them are in Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah.
So it's a unique phenomenon within the natural environment. It's something unexpected. It's something that really provides the awe factor beyond almost anything else that you can see in the park.
I've seen it maybe six times since I've been here over the last couple of days, and it's still, you still wait for it, you watch, you see it happen, and you wait until it's done. It's just incredible.
And it's always different. There's no two eruptions that are ever the same. You can be out here this time of the year versus the middle of the winter when it's 30 degrees below zero, and you can just, the difference in the effect that it has on people is pretty extraordinary.
And it's because we're sitting on top of a supervolcano.
We are indeed. The magma of the Earth is probably closer to the surface here than any place else on Earth.
And you're not worried about an eruption of that supervolcano?
Well, the geologists tell me I don't have to be worried today. It probably will happen someday. They say there's other things that are going on and with the geology of Yellowstone that's not our most immediate threat.
Okay, so let's get back to the threat we were talking about, which is the crowds here. You do not believe the park is being loved to death.
I think the park is being appreciated. I think that we're working very hard with visitors to help them help us protect this place. My biggest concern with visitors is whether or not the crowds are actually affecting their opportunity to enjoy and appreciate Yellowstone. So we have initiated a very robust social science program to really understand the levels of visitation, the effect it has on visitor experience, and the effect it has on the natural resources of the park. But no, not yet is it being loved to death.
Should there be a cap on the number of visitors coming to this park?
Maybe. I don't have the answer to that question yet, but through this social science program and through our resource management programs, I believe that we will get the science that will inform that decision. But it would be premature for me today to say that that's the right answer to the problem.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dan Wenk, who is the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park. And by the way, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the national parks. This is the first one, but it was actually not a national park, but kind of a national park even before 1916.
Well, it was a national park. It was the world's first national park, and it's because the states of no states existed in this area, and Congress carved this out of the territory, and they had no state to give it to, if you will. It was, in fact, called a national park, and it is the 144 years ago in 1872, and it has really set the standard for what national parks can be in terms of telling the natural history and the cultural history of our country, and well over 100 countries throughout the world have public lands or protected areas that do much of what was started at Yellowstone National Park.
You've had a long career yourself in the Park Service, and now you're in charge of this, the flagship park in the system. Where could you possibly go from here?
Nowhere. This is a great assignment. You know, my predecessors did a great job setting me up to have an opportunity to continue their good work in Yellowstone National Park. It's a place that is, I think, really helps to set the tone for what management of protected areas should be throughout the world. This is a job that I aspired to, and was incredibly fortunate enough to be sitting in this chair to have the opportunities we have to protect this place and provide great opportunities for people to visit and to enjoy.
And your favorite place in this park is?
You know, my favorite place is probably as far as you can get away from the roads, and you can be farther away from a road in Yellowstone National Park than any place else in the lower 48. But in the thoroughfare area of Yellowstone, where you can really see, I think, what this country looked like, you know, as part of, if you will, primitive America, and really see what the natural landscape was and can be still if we take proper care of it.
That's Dan Wenk, the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park, joining us live here on the porch at the Old Faithful Inn, and we just saw Old Faithful erupt. Dan Wenk, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The chief diplomat of the Philippines says the country will not leave the United Nations, though the country's president, Rodrigo Duterte, threatened to do so after the UN called for an end to the Philippines' killings of suspected drug traffickers and addicts. Duterte was elected in May after vowing to solve drugs, criminality, and corruption in 3 to 6 months, that's a quote, by whatever means necessary, and since then hundreds have been killed by police and vigilantes. Phelim Kain is deputy director of the Asia Division for Human Rights Watch. And can you explain to us what first alerted you to the extent of the problem in the Philippines?
Well, we became aware of the problem on the horizon during the electoral campaign for now President Rodrigo Duterte, and that electoral campaign was premised on explicit promises to solve the problem of criminality, corruption, and drugs in the Philippines within 3 to 6 months of taking office by whatever means necessary. At one point, he promised to fill Manila Bay with thousands of bodies of executed, quote-unquote, criminals. And since he has taken office on June 30th, the behavior of the Philippines National Police seems to indicate that they have been granted a blank check to take extremely violent and potentially unlawful means to address the issue of drugs, and particularly targeting of so-called suspected drug users and drug dealers. In the last 6 weeks, the police have killed more than 700 suspected drug dealers and drug users.
So shocking in its scale. But to be clear, has he actually specifically directed police to kill suspects on site, or is there some interpretation going on of what he had promised?
President Duterte has used aggressive and lurid rhetoric in terms of describing the drug problem in the Philippines as a national emergency. Now, he hasn't enacted any specific policies, but he has responded to these really horrific numbers by describing this, quote unquote, as a success, and by egging the police on, telling them to keep up the momentum.
Huh. Well, Duterte also campaigned, as you've mentioned, on a law and order platform, saying at an election rally, if I make it to the presidential palace, you drug pushers, hold up men and do nothings, you better get out because I'll kill you. Then again, I mean, he won the presidency in May in the Philippines by a landslide. So how many Filipinos, you know, share his view about the extent of the problem and then also share his views about the means by which they're going about trying to solve it?
Yeah. President Duterte won the election on a plurality of the vote, 40% of the vote. So 60% of Filipinos who voted for someone else. The other important element here is that in the most recent statistics released by the Philippines National Police yesterday are that more than 1,700 people have been killed in this campaign, more than 700 by the police and another 1,000 by unidentified shadowy vigilante killers. But we need to remember that we don't know who these people are. We have no idea if they were drug users or drug dealers All we know is that they ended up dead, and there has been no due legal process. And this is the frightening thing, in the sense that this government cheerleading for this mass bloodletting on the streets of Philippine cities is letting loose forces that can take a gun and use it for whatever purpose they see fit, because they feel the president has given them leeway to do so.
Mm. Now, Phelim, I'm kind of feeling the need for some context here, because on the same day that President Duterte was inaugurated in June, at the end of June, he said publicly, quote, "If you know of any addicts, go ahead and kill them yourself, as getting their parents to do it would be too painful." I mean, what is it that's fueling his extreme positions and extreme rhetoric on this?
President Rodrigo Duterte has a very long record of publicly advocating extremely violent extrajudicial means to address the issue of crime. He was the mayor of the city of Davao in southern Philippines for more than 22 years. During that period, Human Rights Watch documented the existence of a vicious death squad that killed hundreds of people. He has been and continues to be an enthusiastic cheerleader for this violent extrajudicial approach to crime and criminality.
Well, Human Rights Watch wrote an open letter to President Duterte. The UN has condemned what's happening in the Philippines. Has any of that pressure had an effect on what's been going on there? It doesn't seem like he's responding to it.
He has dismissed criticism of this ongoing war on drugs campaign and its associated bloodletting. He is not responding to international pressure to, number one, tell the police in no uncertain terms that they cannot and should not be targeting suspects for extrajudicial execution. And number two, launching a government investigation, urgent and impartial, into these killings. It's taken a lot of people by surprise how badly things have gone so quickly.
Well, Phelim Kine is Deputy Director of the Asia Division for Human Rights Watch. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Meghna, you got your live eruption of Old Faithful. It's Here and Now.